May it please the court, Anthony Noble, registration number 33910, and I represent the appellant, Uriel Esquivel. The main issue on appeal here is whether Mr. Esquivel was denied effective assistance of counsel by his attorney's failure to litigate suppression motions and then advise Mr. Esquivel to plead guilty to one of the counts to which he was given probation. This is a variation of a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, because in addition to having to prove deficient performance and prejudice, we also have to prove that there was a meritorious suppression issue. So there are really three prongs to establish at an evidentiary hearing in this case, and Mr. Esquivel established all three prongs. First, on the deficient performance prong, defense counsel testified that he made a number of mistakes in litigating the suppression motion. He failed to subpoena one of the officers to a preliminary hearing and lock him into testimony about the time that he arrived after the car was stopped and the search was initiated. He also failed to follow through on the destruction of the dispatch logs to try and get some kind of sanction, or to use those, or to use that destruction to gain an advantage in a suppression hearing. And then he also failed to interview witnesses as well, in addition to the police officers who witnessed the various parts of the stop and the search. There are also other witnesses that could testify as to the timing of the event. The main issue here regarding the stop was, you know, how long was Mr. Esquivel detained before the canine officer arrived and searched the vehicle.
Was there any version of the facts that made that length of time more than 15 or 20 minutes?
Yes,
I recall there was something in the logs that said it was hours, but that seemed to be a total mistake.
Well, I think that the police officer's reports were all over the place. I mean, we had Officer Miller, who testified that he stopped the car at 5:46 p.m., and then Officer Stone, who was the canine officer, he arrived later, but in his report, he said that he arrived at 5:18 p.m., and then another officer said that he arrived at 8-something p.m. So, you know, this was one of the merits of the suppression claim, is that the police were all over the place regarding the time that they arrived at the scene. And then, because the dispatch logs and the dispatch recordings have both been destroyed, defense counsel believed that he had a very strong suppression claim, you know, just on that basis alone.
Didn't he also believe that it would be hard to persuade a judge that police may not be fully upfront?
Yes,
fully
he did
accurate?
Testify to that, but he said that because of the these discrepancies in the reports and because of the destruction of the dispatch logs and the recordings, that would help him attack the credibility of the police officers. And in fact, I think that we did persuade the judge that there's a meritorious suppression claim here, because in his findings denying post-conviction relief, he said, you know, he found that the suppression issue was meritorious. So I think that really that part of the case should not really be in dispute, because we have defense counsel who testified that it's a meritorious suppression claim. We have the judge finding that it's a meritorious suppression claim. And then the evidence that I presented at the evidentiary hearing establishes that it is a meritorious suppression claim. Even if we accept the evidence that most favors the prosecution, we have a period of 20 minutes from the stop of the car until the canine officer begins his search. Now, during that time, Officer Miller, who stopped the car, he had run the wants and warrants check, determined that there were no wants or warrants regarding Mr. Esquivel, and he had started writing a warning. This stop and search resulted from a lane usage violation, and he testified that he wasn't even going to give Mr. Esquivel a ticket. He went back to his car, ran the wants and warrants check, started writing a warning, and called the canine officer. The canine officer then arrived on the scene and then had a discussion with Officer Miller before going to the car and then talking to the passenger for about 5 minutes. So during that time, the purpose of the stop should have been completed. The check had already been done, and the warning was being written. So the warning should have been written by that time, and there was no need to prolong the detention to conduct a search of the car. And the police testified that, you know, they had no other reason for the stop and the search. So I think that there clearly is a meritorious suppression issue. And then when we look at the deficiency prong, by plea counsel's own admission, there were numerous mistakes that he made. It wasn't his strategy to abandon the suppression claim. He testified that he had this strategy on pursuing the claim. And what he did is he didn't follow through with what his strategy was. So he didn't call the officer to testify at the hearing. He failed to follow through on the destruction of the dispatch logs. He didn't interview witnesses. For some reason, and he wasn't able to explain why, and the court wasn't able to find, you know, why he abandoned that claim.
Well, there was an explanation, excuse me.
Go ahead, Judge.
There was an explanation, was there not, as to why certain acts were not performed by counsel. That is, what his client wanted as a result of the criminal case being filed. What did his client want?
His client wanted to avoid jail, Your Honor.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then, didn't the trial court find that was a motivating factor in the counsel not pursuing the suppression in order to guarantee the defendant would not be incarcerated?
That's correct. So the court found that that was an overriding concern of the defendants.
And so the attorney's thought, if I understand how this went, is taking the chance, the risk that a judge would disbelieve the police, to follow up on my last question, went to the risk of the possibility of your client going to jail, which appeared to me to be what the focus of the judge's ultimate finding in the 35C hearing was.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's also the heart of the problem of this case, because defense counsel made these decisions.
Well, your client communicated, I don't want to go to jail. I mean,
that's correct.
So that was a decision.
But also by pursuing the suppression motion, you know, he could have got the evidence suppressed, the prosecution's case would have fallen apart, there would be no conviction, no jail. Now,
well, that's a risk that he could have taken.
It is, but it was a risk that he wasn't advised of, Your Honor. Defense counsel admitted at the evidentiary hearing that he didn't talk about what the likelihood of prison versus probation was if he'd lost a trial. He advised him that there was a sentencing range of 4 to 16 years. Now, defense counsel believed that prison was unlikely. He's a defense attorney of over 30 years of experience and represented many people in drug cases in that county. Based on his experience, he determined that prison was unlikely. He also determined that after an unsuccessful trial, probation would be the most likely sentence. Now, he also testified that this particular judge wanted to see drug dealers or drug offenders do jail time. Now, he made the distinction between jail and prison. A jail sentence can be imposed as a term and condition of probation in a felony case, but the maximum jail time is 90 days. So what this comes down to is, on the one hand, Mr. Esquivel could take this risk of pursuing the suppression claim and ultimately losing, going to trial and being convicted, and the sentence most likely being probation with a jail term. And then on the other hand, he could accept this plea, which guarantees probation without jail, but he ends up with a felony conviction. Now, the benefit would be, if he wins the suppression hearing, then the case falls apart. And both defense counsel testified to that, and the judge found that without this evidence, the prosecution's case would be severely weakened.
So,
Go ahead. That's all right.
No. I want to ask counsel about another matter than the suppression matter. I want to ask you about our jurisdiction to hear the appeal on the matter of imposing the cost for the transporting the defendant from New Mexico to Colorado. Why do we have the power to hear that?
Well, I think I've explained that pretty well in the response that I did to the order to show cause. And I think that my main concern with the order to show cause that was issued by this court is it relies on, I think it's the Hill case, which relates to restitution and not cost of prosecution. So what we have here is an order for the cost of prosecution, not restitution. So it's not clear whether or not that is a separately appealable order. But also, there are many distinctions between this case and the Hill case that this court relies on. You know, the first one being is that the order for cost of prosecution was issued like 2 weeks after the order denying post-conviction relief. The notice of appeal was timely filed as to both orders, unlike in the Hill case where the restitution order issued during the pendency of the appeal, and the defendant in that case asked the court to amend the notice of appeal and supplement the designation of record. So here there's really no inconvenience to the Attorney General. They didn't even raise this issue in their brief. They were able to respond to the cost of prosecution argument, and there's no disruption in the court's proceedings. There was no need to amend the notice of appeal or the designation of record, no need to supplement the record. So I think that what this may come down to is just a technical defect in the notice that, you know, I didn't specifically state that there was that January order that I was appealing. But, you know, there's no prejudice that's come to anyone as a result of that.
In fact, it's true that the Attorney General wouldn't be unaware of the appeal until you filed your opening brief.
That's correct. Yeah. Although it obviously didn't prejudice them in any way, because they were able to adequately respond to the arguments that I made in the opening brief. Unless the court has any further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
You have about 3 minutes and 23 seconds.
May it please the court. My name is Jillian Price, registration number 40815, and I represent the people. Plea counsel did have a strategy with respect to the suppression issue, and that strategy was to advance the overriding goal of his client, which was to avoid jail time. Plea counsel stated at the post-conviction hearing that the suppression issue was, quote, better than normal. Mr. Esquivel stated at the post-conviction hearing that it was very important to him to avoid jail, and it was very important to him to avoid prison. Mr. Esquivel's daughter also testified that her dad did not want to go to prison. Plea counsel utilized the strength of the suppression issue to leverage the prosecution into making a plea offer that advanced the goal of avoiding incarceration. Plea counsel explained that he had reviewed the discovery. He had done enough investigation to assess the strength of the suppression issue. He was not required to do any further investigation at that time in order to enter into plea negotiations and thereby obtain the favorable plea offer that he did. Now, had the plea offer not been favorable, had Mr. Esquivel chosen not to accept the plea offer, litigation of the suppression issue would still have been open to plea counsel. However, had he litigated that issue, number one, there's no guarantee that he would have been successful. There's no guarantee that he would have convinced the judge that the police were lying and Mr. Esquivel was telling the truth. And there is no guarantee that the prosecution would have held open the offer that stipulated to no jail time as Mr. Esquivel wanted.
Was there any evidence to the contrary on the last point that if they went to the suppression hearing, the plea offer would go away?
No, there's not. And that is a risk that was presented to Mr. Esquivel in determining whether or not to take this plea. And it was a risk that might have resulted in his ultimate sentence to either jail or prison.
What you just said seems to either contradict or supplement what Mr. Noble said. He did not suggest that at any point counsel told Mr. Esquivel in such words that going up forward with the suppression was a risk that it might go away. You're saying the record supports such a fact finding. I don't think the judge found it either, but you say the record supports that?
The testimony at the post-conviction hearing was this. Through an interpreter, Mr. Esquivel testified that he didn't know what, quote, a motion to suppress was. However, the daughter, who was present for most of Mr. Esquivel's discussions with his counsel, said that, yes, the suppression issue was discussed. She understood it. She had explained it to Mr. Esquivel. He understood what the suppression issue was. Now, plea counsel also testified that he would never tell a client that he would be guaranteed to a probation sentence in any given circumstance.
But did he tell him that if we lose on the suppression issue, your opportunity to take probation without jail time might go away or will go away?
I don't believe that plea counsel made any such statements during the post-conviction hearing, and I don't believe there's any statements in the record that concretely address that particular point. But plea counsel also said that the judge that was hearing this case had said, I think, quote, time and again, that drug offenders will do jail time in Prowers County. Plea counsel was aware of that fact. Plea counsel was aware of the risks. And plea counsel was also aware that even if a suppression motion were successful, there was still other evidence that the prosecution could have relied on to proceed to trial. Now, that evidence was certainly much weaker, and that evidence, or and the prosecution's case certainly would have been weaker if the suppression motion had been granted, but it would have survived and could have proceeded to trial, at which point Mr. Esquivel would be opening himself up to the risk of jail or indeed prison, which was his overriding goal to avoid.
Did plea counsel communicate to Mr. Esquivel the strength of the suppression motion?
I know that they discussed the suppression motion. As previously mentioned, the daughter testified at the
prosecution. I understand, but the strength of it.
I don't believe that there was specific discussion of that at the post-conviction hearing.
So isn't that kind of the heart of this? I mean, in order to weigh whether to go to trial or whether to take a plea, we might really win this.
Well,
weighing against, a judge would have to decide against the credibility of law enforcement. I understand
sure.
all that. But for Mr. Esquivel to make the choice informed whether or not to accept the plea, risk going to jail.
Sure. Well, plea counsel said that the suppression issue was better than normal. Now, to the extent...
So, was that communicated? That's what I'm asking.
Right. That's the communication. So as far as explaining the nuanced details of why it was a better than normal suppression issue, that testimony does not appear in the post-conviction hearing transcripts. But again, based on plea counsel's testimony that this was better than normal and the daughter's testimony that this was all explained to Mr. Esquivel, he was aware of these things. Now, Mr. Esquivel also testified, again, based on his desire not to be incarcerated, based on his age, based on his medical issues, he did not feel that even risking a term of jail or prison was acceptable to him. And sure, nobody wants a felony conviction, but he wanted to avoid jail more than anything else. He also testified that because he worked with his family, with his brother specifically, a felony conviction would not necessarily affect him in the same way that it might anyone else. His goal was to avoid incarceration. And the plea agreement that defense counsel obtained by leveraging the suppression issue advanced that goal. And for those reasons, defense counsel's actions did not constitute deficient performance, and there was no prejudice. And therefore, under Strickland, Mr. Esquivel's claims must fail. Turning to the costs issue, as Mr. Noble stated, the people did, of course, respond to that issue in the brief. Now, the last sentence of Colorado Appellate Rule 3A states that the content of a notice of appeal is not jurisdictional, and under Rule 32B3, a judgment of conviction consists of both the sentence and any cost award, but that cost is listed as part of the judgment of conviction. Based on the people's reading of CAR 3 and CRIM P32D, we did address the issue, again, because a notice of appeal is not jurisdictional. Now, the people would also state that costs and restitution are two separate issues. Costs are not treated as restitution is, and there's no specific statutory authority that exists, as it does for restitution, that says that a cost order is separately appealable. Clearly, if this court determines that it is, then this court would have no jurisdiction to consider that cost issue. But the people disagree that restitution and costs are equivalent to one another as far as how they're determined. That being said, assuming that this court does reach the cost issue, the costs were properly ordered under 18.1.37012 sub J. That subsection provides a catch-all for costs of prosecution. And under People v. Sinovchek, a Rule 35C hearing is part of the continuing litigation of a criminal prosecution. Indeed, it's a collateral attack on the conviction, which the prosecution then needs to defend and therefore continue the prosecution. Because Mr. Esquivel's presence was required at the 35C hearing, the costs were, quote, reasonable and necessary under the statute and were therefore properly awarded. Unless this court has any questions on any of the issues raised, we respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's order. Thank you.
I'd like to address the issue of trial counsel's strategy again, because I think the problem here is that a trial attorney cannot make a strategic decision for a defendant to plead guilty and forgo his right to a trial. And essentially that's what is being argued here, is that defense counsel here made a determination that he would use this strong suppression issue to negotiate a favorable plea, a plea of probation without jail time. But the real problem here is that there was a lack of consultation with Mr. Esquivel about, you know, whether he would want to do this in favor of litigating his suppression issue, which could have resulted in no jail time as well. And by defense counsel's own testimony, you know, this really was not a strategy, because he's testifying about the mistakes that he made in litigating the suppression issue. It was his intention to take this to a suppression hearing and try and win this. But there was
the counsel acknowledged that he could have subpoenaed the sheriff, could have filed up on the records, but he never said that I agreed or I thought it was a good idea to put off the suppression hearing because of any of those things. He just said they may have weakened the ability to argue the suppression, right?
Although, Your Honor, he did say it was a mistake not to follow through with the destruction of the dispatch records.
Did he say that I'm going to vacate the suppression hearing because of that mistake, though? Or did he say we're going to vacate the suppression hearing because the defendant wants to avoid jail time and the quickest route to get there is to accept the plea that's been offered?
Well, Your Honor, I think that he couldn't really explain why he abandoned the suppression issue. By the time we got to the evidentiary hearing, he looked through his file again, and that's where, you know, some of these issues that he raised during his testimony were not claims that I raised in the post-conviction motion. There were issues that he volunteered during the evidentiary hearing. After reviewing his file and being refreshed about the case, you know, he realized that there were things that he didn't do that he should have done.
Sorry to interrupt again. Did he communicate to Mr. Esquivel the weaknesses, the strengths in the suppression issue, to help Mr. Esquivel weigh whether to plea or not plea and go to trial?
I believe that his testimony at the evidentiary hearing was that he did not communicate the nuances of the suppression claim to Mr. Esquivel. And then when you combine
that... But his sister or daughter or whoever disagreed with that some degree.
I think that, you know, they had some idea that they had the suppression claim, but I think that he testified that he didn't go into detail, he didn't discuss the nuances with Mr. Esquivel. So when you combine that with the fact that he didn't really advise Mr. Esquivel what the consequences would be of going to trial and losing, he didn't advise him that, you know, even if you were found guilty after a trial, the most likely sentence would be probation, you know, with a period of jail time, which, you know, the maximum could be 90 days. So this put Mr. Esquivel in a position where he couldn't really balance, you know, what the benefits were of the plea versus, you know, pursuing suppression and going to trial. So I think that under those circumstances, we've established an effective assistance of counsel, and I'd ask the court to reverse the order denying post-conviction relief.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. And that concludes the oral argument docket for today.